Hello and welcome to Bright Wings, children's books to make the heart soar. I am your host, Charity Hill. The purpose of this conversation is to help mothers and fathers identify books that will liberate their children to embrace truth, goodness, and beauty. We love the words truth, goodness, and beauty, don't we? They ring in us. They resonate with us. When we hear the words truth, goodness, and beauty, we say yes inside ourselves and we nod our heads. You're here listening to this podcast because you're hoping to find books that harmonize with these ideas. We love the transcendentals, but perhaps if somebody asked us to explain them, we wouldn't know what to say. You might get a little flummoxed. When it comes to the words beauty, truth, and goodness, we can think, I like what you're saying, Charity, but don't ask me to explain it to someone else. We are going to put flesh onto these concepts. We are going to put teeth into these concepts so that you can identify them yourself and so that you can talk about them yourself. We are going to give it a go. So first, I'm going to give you a lot more language for seeing truth, identifying beauty, and recognizing goodness. I'm going to give you more vocabulary. I will talk about the features of each of the transcendentals, and I will share with you several exemplary books for each category. Let's begin with the concept of truth. If you are looking for truthful books, what are you looking for? Books that are true will reflect the structure of reality, the nature of reality as created by God. Books that are true will first answer the question, what is? They confirm and affirm order in nature, biology, and human relationships. Truth in our books will be seen in consequences for choices and behaviors. Truth will be seen in paradoxes and in grace. Books that are true will depict goodness and evil for what they are, and not merely circumstantial. Age-appropriate truthfulness means also that once there is a mature understanding of good and evil, we can explore characters' inconsistencies and compromises. So, true books. Let's unpack each of the features of truthful books that I just named. Okay. When I say we want books which reflect the structure of reality, the nature of reality as created by God, and that these books will answer the question, what is? This is as simple as just going back to board books. These lay the foundation for your child's understanding of what is real and how to name it. My first child, one of her first words after Dada was this, Mama, this. We would take her in our arms and we'd walk around and she would point to everything. She wanted to know the name of everything. She wanted to know what is. And frankly, it's not a surprise that this child is one of the most interested and curious young people I've ever met. This. What is real and how to name it? Does the book confirm my child's understanding, for example, in a board book, that animals in the book are real in the world? This correspondence between books and created reality that we see in board books should continue as your child ages. I would say that our books need to reflect a true anthropology. That is, what is a human person? And what are they for? Is the human person made good? Made for relationship? Not an instrumental good? If the book doesn't arrive at a true understanding of human nature by its conclusion, we should question whether they should read it. And definitely a student shouldn't read such a book on their own, but such a book should be read and talked about in conversation with an adult, with a teacher or a parent. The difference I'm talking about here is the difference between My Side of the Mountain and Hatchet. See other podcasts if you want to know what I mean. For an older child, another feature of a truthful book is that it confirms and affirms order. There is an order to nature and biology, for example. There is an order of justice. There are consequences for choices and actions. There is cosmos or chaos, and they are not the same. We can ask, Does the book reflect the truth about what freedom is? That freedom has a direction and fulfillment, for example. As examples, I would say this is the difference between The Hidden Treasure of Glaston and Crispin Cross of Lead. When books are truthful, goodness and evil are depicted for what they are. Evil is not merely circumstantial. An evil character is not simply a misunderstood person. The quickest example of this I can think of is actually from a movie, if you'll pardon it. And the example is Moana. At the end of Moana, we discover that the volcano goddess isn't bad. She's just been mistreated and misunderstood. But because we're Christians, or because we're wise, and we're not simply behaviorists, we must admit that we are, and our children are, responsible actors. Evil can and is chosen on purpose. And we don't need a dark book to know that this is true. Peter Rabbit immediately and deliberately does exactly what Old Mother Bunny tells him not to do. Truthful books show that good and evil have consequences. A truthful book shows that goodness and evil are opposed to one another. A truthful book will also demonstrate that there are really bad enemies who are evil and need to be defeated, like Mr. McGregor, or in The Last Quest of Gilgamesh by Ludmilla Zeman, Ishtar needs to be defeated, and even death. To loosely quote Simone Weil, she says that we tend to imagine evil as romantic and varied, and goodness as lame. But, quote, real evil is actually gloomy, monotonous, barren, boring, and real goodness is always new, marvelous, intoxicating. Truthful books will show us that though evil may appear glamorous and interesting, it is really violent and empty. Truthful books show us that goodness is, in fact, marvelous and satisfying. I think of John Henry, the American Tale, and Summer of the Monkeys. I think of Treasure Island, The Secret Keepers. All of these books show us that real goodness is new, marvelous, and intoxicating. And evil is actually gloomy, monotonous, violent, barren, boring. As children grow in maturity, they can explore the complexities of the human situation and discover that the truth is complex. Once a clear sense of good and evil are established, we can, with wisdom, show the truth that our human situation is nuanced. True stories will reflect complex problems in an age-appropriate way. Certainly, our children will be beset with problems because there is, as I would say, original sin. The compass doesn't always point north. Notice, original sin, though, is less original than the goodness and the gift at the origin of our life. True stories will reflect this original goodness and not take chaos or randomness as normative. For the more mature child, it is formational for them to explore the inconsistencies, failures, and moral compromises of characters. It helps form them. The child can encounter characters in fiction that show him that the line separating good and evil goes right through the human heart. Here we need only think of Sweet Anne of Green Gables and her need to reform her temper, or of Edmund Pevensey's pettiness towards his siblings, which leads to Aslan's death. But let me say, harshness is not simply congruent with truth-telling. For example, in The Midwife's Apprentice by Karen Cushman, life in the Middle Ages is depicted with such harshness that it feels like a slap to the modern reader, whose brain and experience have been dropped into a different time and place. This harshness is, I'd argue, anachronistic. Medieval people did not know that their lives were harder than ours in many respects. They didn't know they were colder or hotter or had worse medical care than us, or that our beds were softer than theirs. And so such harshness, often it's done in an intentionally ugly way or a cognitively dissonant way. Such harshness can actually inhibit receiving the truth about different historical periods with understanding. Thomas Aquinas says that truth is received in the mode of the receiver. Our books must communicate the truth with nuance, with awareness of the receiver or the reader, without relativizing what is objective. The most important truth our literature must affirm is the goodness at the heart of reality that acts as a sacramental of God's presence. What are the questions we need to ask concretely? I think we need to ask, what does this book say about what it means to be human? Are humans inherently good? Are people made for relationships? How are these vital truths shown or hidden or distorted? We can ask, what does this book say about the order of human relationships, what our tradition calls justice? What happens when someone does something bad? We can also ask, how is evil depicted in this book? What would a reader learn about lying or loyalty, courage, selfishness, generosity in this book? What kind of maturity would a reader need in order to grasp the truth in this book? What kind of adult support would a reader need? Now, don't worry, y'all. You don't have to make notes as you're listening to this podcast. I'm actually going to attach in the show notes a really lovely PDF I've crafted for you that helps you ask yourself all of these discerning questions. It would be additionally extremely lovely of you if you use this PDF in your family. Perhaps you could consider this, especially though if you're using it in a classroom or on a library committee or anything like this. If you wouldn't mind donating $5, would that be reasonable? $5 to the PayPal link on my website. So that would be such a kind gesture of yours. All right, let's continue. So we've talked about truth. Let's continue by talking about goodness. How do we find books that show goodness? First of all, obviously, books that are good will be books that have literary excellence. They'll have insightful and innovative use of language and vocabulary and sentence structure. Books that are good will feature goodness. Goodness. We want books that highlight goodness, books that feature goodness. And certainly these should go together, literary excellence, that kind of goodness, and goodness, as in a quality of the soul, right? Do our children's books show how wonderful the created world is, echoing God's benediction, and he saw that it was good? Our earliest children's books should reflect Eden, should reflect the original gift as the norming human situation. If we are looking for goodness in books, we can begin by asking, do our children's books show how wonderful the world is? Books that feature goodness will foster a child's connection to certain given goodnesses. Embodiment, family, home, and place. This means that our books should show the goodness of created things. How does a book reveal or distort this? Now, let me pause a minute because I might be getting into some territory that sounds unusual to you. Yes, good and bad action, but most of all, I'm thinking about like metaphysical goodness. I'm talking about goodness at the level of being before I am considering goodness at the level of doing. And this is actually crucial. We want goodness at the level of being. Of course, we want it at the level of the character's actions as well. But first, let's consider how does a book reveal or distort the goodness at the heart of reality, at the heart of being? Think of how hobbits remind us of the goodness of created things. Tilled earth, dew, bread. Or Mr. and Mrs. Beaver and their home in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Little House in the Big Woods or Farmer Boy. The Wind in the Willows. These characters and stories declare the goodness of simple things, the goodness of existence. And so books which feature goodness will foster my child's connection to the world, his delight at the world that is right at his fingertips. And not just fiction, but also nonfiction should follow this principle. It is my perception that nonfiction is getting better at looking at the world with wonder and not as an opportunity for dissection. The highly popular hand-drawn work of the studies by Julia Rothman, she's known for her books Food Anatomy, Farm Anatomy, Nature Anatomy, is a good example. And these are more science-y books, right? But I think that more science-y books are being written in a narrative style. And I appreciate this because I think this allows the wonder of creation to be perceived. Books which are typified by goodness are also peopled by characters you wouldn't mind having as your child's friend. I think of My Side of the Mountain, Miracles on Maple Hill, Betsy Tacy, and the book Here in the Real World by Sarah Pennypacker, The Mysterious Benedict Society by Trenton Lee Stewart, and The Chronicles of Narnia. What kinds of actions or choices are readers drawn to or attracted to in reading this book? If we are looking for goodness, we should ask, what are readers inspired or tempted to do? What kinds of actions are treated as normal or expected? Goodness should be some way normative, even if there is a problem to be solved or suffered. Also, books which feature goodness will be redemptive. And what I mean by that is that a redemptive book will move from a state of disorder to a state of truer balance or integration. I think of this profound book, A Single Shard, by Linda Sue Park. Say that you're holding a book in your hand and you're wondering, is this book good? I would ask you, even if the book does not refer to God or Jesus, does it reflect a Christian worldview? What does this book declare to be good? What are the characters fighting for? What are they seeking? In what direction does the main character develop? How are immoral actions depicted? As harmful? Insidious? Intriguing? Glamorous? Does it encourage reverence for the mystery of the human person and respect for the reader's own human dignity? Does this book foster wonder? Already in the truth category, I mentioned that the difference between good and evil must be evident. We can ask, does this book depict goodness in a way that fosters desire for it? What level of maturity is required for children to engage with or understand the good and evil depicted in this book? All right, so we have discussed truth and goodness. Now, let's turn our gaze to beauty. Why do beautiful illustrations matter? I've had several podcasts on the topic or dancing around the topic of beauty. Why do beautiful illustrations matter? Are they just ornamental? Are they extra? Maybe they're useful? Gotcha there. Of course, beauty increases engagement in the story and helps to tell the story as well. But more than that, beauty is essential because she shows our children the deep marvelousness of truth and goodness. The gratuity of beauty shows the gratuity of the world, that the deepest truth about the world is a gift, a truth that is fully positive. Surrounding our students and our children with beauty gives them a standard by which to judge. beauty gives them a vision by which to see. Beauty gives children a gut-level instinct for measuring other images and experiences in their life. Beauty calibrates, beauty attunes our children for what is true and good. Robert Spemann puts it this way, quote, "We learn to distinguish between beautiful and ugly by growing out of crude judgments that I like that or I don't like that, and by fashioning in ourselves an organ for the perception of objective qualities. But this happens in the first place through an encounter with beauty, through involvement with the beautiful, and through learning to do whatever one does in a beautiful manner." That's from Education as an Introduction to Reality. Beautiful books will be beautiful in their images and actions. Huh, what could that mean? They will be beautiful in two ways, in image and in action. First, I'll talk about the visual aspect. Beautiful books will indicate the symmetry, the vividness, the gratuity, the liveliness, the peace, the texture, the wholeness of created reality. Such images will be naturalistic, recognizable for what they're representing. A beautiful image will be human, a time-consuming creation from someone who invested their creativity over years. It will be executed with technical skill using elements of art. Beautiful illustrations invite rather than coerce attention. Very often, beautiful illustrations will need you to take time to really see and understand the image. Let me unpack these notions in greater detail. How can we know if something is beautiful? Let me name some concrete features. First, is it clear what is being illustrated? Look for books with simple, naturalistic illustrations. And I'm going to name some illustrators: Shirley Hughes, Jerry Pinkney, PJ Lynch, Garth Williams, Luyen Pham, Kinuko Kraft. Remember, we want to facilitate our child's recognition of what is. Illustrations should be easily recognized for what they're representing, but not too cartoonish, inflated, elongated, or disproportionate. There should be realistic colors and representations. Trees should look like trees, right? I used to hate Dr. Seuss as a kid, not for political reasons, but because they were just so unlike my world. The figures were so odd and twisted. I'm really not sure that surrealism is a great idea for our littlest children, like Dolly and the soft clocks, dystopian things that are from like a weird planet. So even though I can enjoy surrealism at this point, really strong surrealism may not be age appropriate. I'm just suggesting that. So trees should look like trees. And the more human the art is, the better. So how much human investment of time and artisanship was necessary on the part of the artist and illustrator? Was this image a time-consuming creation from a person who has invested their creativity and artisanship? Your children and students are entering a relationship with the artist as well as the art. Could a computer easily generate these images? Computers don't have this reciprocity of relationship. The pictures our children view, whether on screen or in a book, will fill up their imaginations and calibrate their desires. Illustrations that shape a desire for truth and goodness will invite attention instead of grabbing it. Good illustrations are confident that they're worth gazing at. They aren't insecure about their importance. They don't try to coerce a child with bright, simple colors or a blistering confusion of images to convince you that reading is fun. I think this is really a kind of propaganda. We do not welcome these types of books that are a jumble of text and colors. We do, however, welcome richly detailed books. These books are not busy, they're detailed. They reward sustained attention and encourage contemplation. I think sometimes this reflection that a child can have when engaged in beautiful images can be very profound, similar to the cognitive emotional experience that deep reading is for adults. Children can enter a kind of altered state gazing at illustrations. I remember an experience of contemplation reading Margaret Hodges' version of St. George and the Dragon, illustrated by Trina Shart Hyman. I remember reading it for the first time, hanging over the illustrations, longing for I don't know what. I drank in the beauty of Una. I worried at the wounds of St. George, and I didn't even like to look at the claws or the eyes of the dragon. I was in second grade. The words were a little hard to read, and the book was long. I remember I was at my desk, and the windows were on the left. I remember that the teacher may have even started a lesson, but I was immersed. I was ignoring her, and she, I think, let me finish the book. And those pictures are seared into my soul. They matter. They calibrate. Whatever the materials or style demonstrated in the pictures, they should be executed with technical skill. The excellent text of the book should be matched with artistic mastery, the ability to use texture and color with good effect, the ability to draw figures from different angles, the artist's ability to indicate something insightful about the story. A story that is true and good deserves beautiful pictures so that its truth and goodness can literally be seen and recognized, so it can be shown forth. So far, I've spoken of the visual element of beauty, the dimension of beauty that is most obvious to us when we consider the concept of beauty that we're looking for in our books. But what about books with no images? Is beauty absent then? Hardly, right? Beauty can still be present. What are we looking for then? We'll notice beauty in both the innovative use of language and vocabulary and sentence structure, right? Beautiful language, but it will also be evident in the plot and character development and action of the story. Beautiful action is what makes your heart want to burst as you read. Think about Where the Red Fern Grows, or Charlotte's Web, or The Little Prince. A book that changed my life in the last few years was The Hiding Place by Corrie Ten Boom. Right? Raise your hand if you've ever cried reading The Littlest Angel. You probably sobbed. It is not really the illustrations, is it? It's the beautiful actions. It's beautiful actions that keep attracting us to books, keep us returning to books, right? Think of the character Dickon from The Secret Garden by Frances Hodges Burnett. Not only every person, beast, and bird in the book loves Dickon, but we, all of us readers like him, boys and girls love Dickon because he is beautiful. I think beautiful action makes your heart want to burst because it tempts you to think that it is possible to be so great, that it is possible to be more marvelous, more magnanimous, more loving than you are. It tempts you to risk. This attraction to beauty, this attraction to beautiful action also inspires us to change our life. I want to take a moment to talk about the impact of beauty on the formation of our children and students. In attraction to beauty, my son says in his heart, here is one like me. I can be like that. Or he says, I see how good this is. I desire to be like this, to do such actions, or to accept this circumstance. Because beauty can shape and impact my child's desire, I think beauty plays a supremely pivotal role in moving our children toward virtuous action and toward integrating emotion and action. My previous podcast, the one just prior to this one, I talk about this in great detail. Okay, so this is one way you can discern whether a book is beautiful. You can ask, does this book inspire me to change my life? This impact of beauty on me doesn't have to be The Brothers Karamazov, although it is a favorite of mine. This impact can be very simple. For example, in The Raft by Jim LaMarche, a boy's father insists that he spend the summer with the grandma, a self-taught artist who lives beside a river. At first, we're dismayed that the boy is left and lonesome. And then he becomes more proficient at rafting, fishing, observation, drawing, swimming, getting along with his grandma, and being part of life in and along the river. At the end of the book, we don't want the boy to leave the river. Or we want to go to the river ourselves and undertake the same kind of life. So in the first two-thirds of this podcast, I've tried to give you more language to help identify truth, beauty, and goodness. I've tried to put some teeth into these concepts so that you can get a grip on what they mean and use them to identify truth, beauty, and goodness out in the wild, in the books in your home, in the books at your library. I'm going to give you a few hot takes about my own house rules. And if it helps, you can adopt some of my house rules for your own house to help you formulate your own rules for discernment. Then I'm going to briefly revisit a statement of purpose about books that I bring up in episode one. And then I'm going to share with you some language and give you a chance to think about your own mission statement and how to talk about that to other people outside your home. Talk about it to yourself and to those outside your home, maybe. Okay, let's get started with Hill House rules. My first house rule is all books need to be on the scale from benign to excellent. So first, do no harm. This means no morally problematic books, no vampire books, for example, no books with sexual immorality. Another Hill House rule, no books from TV shows or movies. First, because they're super poor quality. They usually have impressively pathetic writing. You can easily make an outright ban on books based on TV shows or movies. Some other suggestions. Try not to bristle as I list them. No Diary of a Wimpy Kid, no Junie B. Jones, no Ivy and Bean, and no Dogman. There are alternatives to these books out there that are actually good. I would recommend Way of the Warrior Kid, Goonie Bird Green, Clementine, Waylon, Betsy, Tacy, and Tib, even Nathan Hale's Hazardous Tales. Seriously, don't clutch your pearls. I think most of them are okay. Another house rule. I have veto power over books that come home from the library. And just as parents have veto power, teachers should have this same veto power over what is on the classroom shelves and what comes into their classroom. Teachers should be able to veto what does not fit the educational mission. School leaders, you need to have an explicit anthropology that helps you make these decisions. If you do not have an explicit anthropology, you will have an implicit and implied anthropology that probably follows the ideas of 90% of the culture. Have a clearly defined concept of what a human person is and what they're for, a clearly defined concept of the good, so that your teachers are liberated to be able to say this book does or does not fit that vision. Teachers, if you have to operate in an area of huge ambiguity, there is one idea I have for you. You might consider having a no outside books policy so students can read any of the good things that are on your shelf. I think that's pretty difficult to argue for, and I think it's actually easier to say that you can have a book policy in your classroom analogous to food sharing. That is, you can bring food from home, but you can't share it with your classmates. So Junior can read a book that you wouldn't have on your classroom shelf, but he cannot let his friend read over his shoulder, and he can't share the book in your classroom with another student. Then at least you are an extension of that child's parents' own house rules. All right, another in-house rule. I would try to emphasize the classics and modern works that are inspired by the classics. But a caveat for my highly conscientious listeners, not everything I think on the shelf can be a classic, maybe. That just isn't possible for every in the same way that it's not possible for every meal to be perfectly balanced or nutrient dense. The books on the shelves of my home are meant to be to for my children an introduction into reality. The books on my shelves are meant to be a kind of taste of the dappled things, for skies of coupled color, for landscape plotted and pieced, all trades, their gear and tackle and trim, all things counter, original, spare, strange, fickle, freckled, swift, slow, sweet, sour, dazzle, dim. I want my children to get the sense that Christ plays in 10,000 places, lovely in limbs and eyes not his, through the features of men's faces. I want my children to sense that God's word to us in creation and in Christ is not yes and no, but a wholehearted yes. I want the books on my shelves to be an introduction to reality. Can you tell I feel passionate about this? So the work of my home, the work of a school, is to give children tastes of the good life, of the goodness of reality. Your aim is to shape a mature palate. Your aim is to grow an integrated humanity. You may spread a feast, and they can only take nibbles, because at the moment, they are full of Cheetos and Mountain Dew. But do spread the feast. Offer them tastes. Taste and see that the Lord is good. And his goodness is a kaleidoscope of flavors. Remember as Christians that the point is to become what we eat in a Eucharistic sense. And I would love your mission, your within your family regarding books, to be guided by this kind of joy, this kind of openness and embrace. Perhaps as you've been listening to this podcast about how to discern what is true, good, and beautiful, you've realized that once you start discerning, you're never really going to be able to go back. Maybe that's also why you kind of need the language, more language for truth, goodness, and beauty. But once you start being discerning like this, you may realize that you have to defend your choices. And I want to help you with that. I want you to be able to do that in a way that is charitable, right? In a way that is good news to whoever you're speaking to. And I want you to be able to do that in a way that is also shrewd, not rude, shrewd. And I think one of the important things to do as we're working on this is to acknowledge that there are a couple of common myths out there, a couple of myths that need debunking. One of the myths out there regarding reading that needs debunking is this, that if your child is reading, it doesn't matter at all what they read. Reading and being a reader is so important that the content doesn't matter. We shouldn't be fussy. I think it's important to acknowledge that this is partially true, even as I think it is generally false. I think it's partially true because insofar as a child is not a strong reader, is not healthy, let's say, in what they're eating, you have to let them eat what's going to keep them alive. But that is not a good place to live. That's not a good place to stay. That's not a healthy way to grow. And it would not be responsible to leave a child there. Okay, a second myth out there that you're likely to have to confront, either within your own heart or outside of you, on social media often, is the proposal that if you restrict what books come into your home or into your classroom, that you are practicing censorship and book banning. How can you respond to this in a way that is charitable, in a way that is good news, and in a way that is shrewd? I would first begin by using the word curation. We all want things curated for ourselves. Somebody has thought ahead about what's going to be awesome, what's going to be appropriate and suitable. We do this all the time. There's a very practical consideration here, which is that there isn't time for everything. So I'm going to curate some of the best there is. The books on my shelves are an extension of my mission as a mother, to mother my children towards their destiny. And the mission of my family is to form children who belong to Christ, who belong to this destiny. And the books on my shelves will be broad and deep, marvelous, curious, age-appropriate, all that I said before. They're being curated with a larger perspective in mind. Because let's face it, if we don't curate our books, what is going to go on our shelves is going to be the dominant political flavor that's currently popular at the major publishing houses. If you do not curate, those ideas will predominate. What you have on your shelf are the opinions and religious and political and social agenda of the major publishing houses on your shelf. It's not to remain neutral, because actually, my friends, I really think neutrality is not possible. This is why I think we must be awake, aware, and thoughtful. That is to say, all books have a perspective. When I curate, I'm not being a Nazi. I am being responsible, right? If you're going to say yes to what is worth reading, you must say no to what isn't. It's okay to have high standards, and it's okay to have boundaries. What else needs to be said here about book curation? There are books that are worth reading, but given a scholar's age, should be read in community rather than alone. A couple that come to mind immediately are Roll of Thunder, Hear My Cry, and To Kill a Mockingbird. Both worth reading, but both definitely merit reading in community, reading with a wise adult. I take my responsibility as a mother and an educator so seriously, and these words called censorship, they really make me want to draw my sword. We need to understand that this is not censorship, that this is curation, this is responsibility, this is education. You must not be confused or afraid. In this regard, I've been inspired by the artist and blogger Haley Durocher, or maybe it's Durocher. She writes, "The last frontier to conquer in the progressives' battle to create a completely sexually permissive society is childhood. Do not concede. Parents have a right to protect their own children and the adults in society." This means you. And this means you parents, you teachers, have a responsibility to make sure that children are provided a safe and true and good and beautiful learning environment, growing environment, formative environment. It is my hope that I have equipped you to see truth, to identify beauty, and to recognize goodness more profoundly, more truly for yourself. I hope that I have given you language that fills out these concepts for you and that inspires you with hope, inspires you with joy, and inspires you with courage. Giving your children books full of truth, goodness, and beauty is worth working for. It's worth defending. It's worth fostering. And it's a hill worth dying on. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being thoughtful and intentional. If this podcast has helped you, I would encourage you to please share it with a friend, a sibling, a teacher, or a school administrator. In the show notes of this podcast, I am giving you a PDF of what I'm calling a literature discernment worksheet. All the questions that I ask myself that help me see whether something is true or good or beautiful, all those questions, I put them all in one place so that you can have ready access to it. You can print this off and it can help you make decisions so that you can identify what books are true, good, and beautiful. The questions on the literary discernment worksheet are also great prompts to have meaningful conversations with your children or your students about literature and things that really matter.